Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Illinois Bell against Box. Mr. Covey.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Ty Covey, and I represent AT&T in this appeal. This case involves two rulings by the Illinois Commerce Commission interpreting rules and orders of the FCC interpreting the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996. At the district court level, we lost on the entrance facilities issue and won on the fiber loops issue. We have appealed the entrance facilities issue, and the ICC has cross-appealed on fiber loops. The standard of review for both issues is de novo, and I'll begin with the entrance facilities issue. To talk about entrance facilities, I first need to spend just a minute on the 1996 Act itself. The core purpose of the 1996 Act was to open local telephone markets to competition, and Congress did this by imposing various duties on incumbent local exchange carriers, that is, the traditional monopoly local exchange carriers like AT&T, formerly known as SBC, formerly known as Ameritech.
Mr. Covey, before you get too far into this, I have to say, I think most of us in this court have been through the 1996 Act a few times, and certainly the Supreme Court has. And what I would like you to do in as clear and as concise a way as you can is tell me physically, what do you say an entrance facility is? There's a little bit of inconsistency between your opening brief and your reply brief on that point.
An entrance facility is a facility owned by an incumbent LEC that connects the
I understand that much. Is it a wire? Is it a box? Is it a circuit board? Is it
It's a wire, a cable. It's a wire. Here's AT&T switch. Here's a competing carrier switch. It's a cable that runs between those two locations and carries transports traffic between those two locations.
So it's just a cable, or is it a cable that you'd splice into? Or, I mean, what exactly are we talking about here? I didn't find your diagrams to be particularly helpful.
Well, there are, if you're talking about a telecommunications network, AT&T has a number of, you know what a switch is, right?
Oh, I certainly do.
Okay. There's a number of switches in this network. It connects each one of its switches with what are called inter-office transport facilities, that are the facilities that carry traffic from one switch to the next. An entrance facility is just a type of inter-office transport facility, except rather than run between two AT&T switches, it runs between an AT&T switch and a CLEC switch.
Right, and so I thought that what the ICC was saying was when this entrance facility was being used solely for the purpose of network-to-network connection, as you just described, CLEC to ILEC, basically, this fell within the terms of the interconnection purpose. Now, it certainly would serve all sorts of purposes to draw that line, since it would force the CLECs to create the infrastructure to take traffic back to their own customers, the backhaul traffic. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, so the economics of it, even if it's the same physical equipment as you argue in your briefs, the economics of it are quite different if you draw the line that the ICC drew.
Well, the problem with the ICC did say, you know, they can have that facility for what they say is solely the purpose of interconnection.
Right. And so that, now if they're going to use it for other – if they were using it for two things before and they can only use it for one thing now, then they've got to furnish the other service now differently.
Right. And the problem with the whole focus on the use of the facility is it's a red herring because under the definition of interconnection in Section 251C2, that doesn't impose any duty on incumbent LECs to provide – transport facilities to competing carriers at all.
Well,
it's simply outside the definition.
I think that
Now I'm lost. The statute says the right of interconnection is at any technologically feasible place. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why the entrance facility, as you described, is not a technologically feasible place. Right? So if there's a right of interconnection, and that's what the Federal Communications Commission said, that these things can be used for the Subsection 2, right of interconnection. I now don't understand what the difference is between that and what you are complaining about.
And I think the difference...
Is it just the terms on which compensation is paid?
Well, I think that's part of it. The difference is the difference between interconnection and unbundling. Interconnection is the right...
The ICC's brief says that AT&T can tell whether this cable is being used for traffic between one customer of the CLEC and another. So if it's used, if AT&T can tell that, then it can insist that this cable be used only for the purpose of interconnection between its customers and the CLEC's customers. And then I don't understand what this is all about.
The problem is that under the 1996 Act, a network facility is a network element. The only provision under the 1996 Act that allows, under which an incumbent can be required to provide its network elements to competitors at telework-based rates is Section 251C3 in the impairment test.
That's not true. C2 says that the CLEC has a right to interconnect, which means at a technologically feasible place, which means the CLEC can point to a place and say, I will interconnect right there, and an interconnection is to some physical facility owned by the ILEC. So the incumbent points to the entrance facility and says, I will interconnect right there. Don't they have that right under the statute?
They can point to a specific point where the two networks will link together. But that's not what they've done here.
Wait a minute. I think, in fact, there are two things I want to say about this. Reading your first brief, I actually had the impression that you were talking about some Euclidean point, you know, that has no dimension, no physicality to it at all. And that can't be right. I think it has to be this kind of more common parlance point that Judge Easterbrook is talking about. And there, you are insisting on calling this, in some sense, network unbundling, but the statute also recognizes that you're going to take a piece of the AT&T network, if you will, facilities of AT&T, and that's the place where you're going to interconnect. But the statute imagines that. The statute doesn't think that this is going to happen just in some hypothetical dimensionless universe.
Well, what the statute says and what the ICC itself found in its 2004 order is that interconnection, as it's defined in 251C2, speaks to a competing carrier providing all the facilities and equipment necessary to reach the incumbent carrier's network.
That's why I wanted you to get more specific about the lines. And it seems that you think that what the CLEC is going to do is force you to lease a rather large chunk of your network to it so that it can accomplish this interconnection. As I read the ICC's order, that doesn't strike me as a rational assumption. They want to connect in, and I really am having trouble visualizing exactly what the difference is between you.
Our position is they can connect at our switch, but under 251C2, our obligation is to allow interconnection for the facilities and equipment
supplied by
the requesting carrier.
Why only at your switch? Why can't they say, I will interconnect, and I'm now going to name a technologically feasible place, and that is the entrance facility? Is there anything in the statute that prevents them from saying that?
Well, the statute talks about, and I think we're back here to the point issue, if they want to point to, say, an end of the entrance facility and say we're going to tie to your network at some, you know, designated point there, and that's where we'll hand off traffic to each other, that might be one thing, but what they're talking about here is leasing a network element.
I just don't get it. You've told us that the entrance facility is a cable, a physical thing that runs between a CLEC switch and an ILEC switch, right? So the CLEC has already its switch tied to one end of this entrance facility, and it says, we're going to deliver our traffic, we're going to interconnect at the place where this entrance facility meets our switch. It's already there, and they say, it's technologically feasible, boom. What's to prevent that?
Because I think there's a difference between, and I hope I'm not just repeating myself, connecting at that point where the two networks tie together and leasing the entire network element that runs.
Tell me what the difference is.
The difference is now they're getting a network element at a telework-based rate when the definition of interconnection.
Tell me, be concrete. What is the difference? Are we fighting about price? And if so, what is the difference in price? Is there a difference in which the way price is calculated for these, depending on whether this is sub 2 or sub 3. And if it's not price, what is the difference concretely?
I think the practical difference is price.
All right. Okay. Now, what is the difference in price? What is the difference in the way in which these prices are calculated?
If we have to provide a network element as a so-called interconnection facility, the price is the Telerik-based price, the exact same price as if entrance facilities had to be unbundled.
Can I ask you once again to be a little more specific?
Yes.
Are you saying that there is a length of cable? I'm probably not using the right words, but are you saying that there's, you know, a 10-meter long length of cable that the CLEX want that you don't want to lease to them because you think they should be connecting in some different place or they don't need all 10 meters? Or what is it that you're saying?
Well, I was trying to explain the pricing difference.
Yeah, right. And so that's why I say, I mean, intuitively looking at these briefs, it looks to me like you think they want a bigger parcel of your network, that this quote-unquote entrance facility is somehow a bigger thing and thus a network element and you don't have to unbundle it. I mean, I understand, I follow all of that, except what I can't follow is concretely what it is you don't want to do, what it is you think they do want to do, and what the ICC order, in fact, allows them to do.
What they want to do is they want to pay a what's called a Telerik cost-based price.
I know they want
price.
To pay the
okay.
Telerik rate for whatever it is they
right, for
want.
Whatever it is. And if we don't, if we're not required to provide that under interconnection or unbundling, they'll pay, either they'll build it for themselves, or if they're buying it from us, they'll buy a tariffed access service,
well,
which
I
is
hate
a different
to borrow
higher rate.
From a previous president, but what is the it that we are talking about here?
Well, if they lease the entrance facility, the it is
the entrance
use of the
facility,
cable.
Which I still don't. Okay, so some cable. And
okay.
You don't think they should have the use of the cable?
Right. If they buy...
How can they not have the use of the cable if the whole cable is the entrance facility?
Yeah, they're entitled to the use of the cable. They can name the cable as a place of interconnection.
But
they're going to use the cable one way or the other. Are we agreed on that?
They can use it one way or the other, yes.
Right.
If there's no... Right.
Can they interconnect without going through the entrance facility?
Yes. They can either, as the FCC found in its unbundling analysis, they can build it for themselves, build a connection for themselves. They can lease it from a third-party provider.
So they have to have the equivalent of the... of the entrance facility to do the interconnection.
Right. As under as Section 251C2 says, they have to provide the facilities and equipment to get to the incumbent LEX network and connect with that network at a designated point.
But there has to be that point of connection somewhere. And that could be any technologically feasible place, right?
Well, point. I mean, I don't know what I'm quibbling, but...
any point on the entrance facility.
But not... And our argument is not the entire entrance facility, not the entire... network element.
Suppose, look, let me try the question a different way. Suppose C3 were repealed tomorrow morning and there were no such thing as unbundled network elements. C2 would remain. AT&T would have an obligation to interconnect. And at what price would this obligation be fulfilled?
The statute says it's a cost-based price under Section 252D1, which
well,
in the FCC...
Telerik is a cost-based price.
The FCC says that's Telerik, yes.
Now I'm just totally lost. If you're telling me that C3, if it were repealed tomorrow, that AT&T's price for interconnection would be a Telerik-based price, which is probably right, then it sounds like the CLECs have a right of access to the entrance facility at the Telerik price. So you're arguing in this litigation that they don't have a right of access to the entrance facility at the Telerik price. Instead, what they get is a right of access to the entrance facility at the Telerik price.
I think that the difference is with unbundling, they get the entrance, they get to use the entrance facility and they pay for it at Telerik. With interconnection, they don't get that. They pay for, under the Telerik methodology, whatever services or products we provide to them at our switch to accommodate the interconnection. We've talked about a cross-connect in our briefs. We charge a Telerik-based price for the cross-connect.
I'm just totally lost. Now, maybe this is my failing for not being a specialist in the business, but given the way the world is actually wired, they are going to ask for access at the entrance facility because you've already told us that the entrance facility connects your switch to theirs. There's no reason for them to ask for access at any other place. So I don't understand. If you tell me Telric supplies the rules for the pricing either way, I not only don't understand what physical difference there is, I don't understand what economic difference there is. And I'm now totally flummoxed by what this litigation is about.
Okay.
If you can't explain it to me in a way that I can understand, this is going to be very unfortunate.
The economic difference is, and maybe I'll try it another way, is, again, it's the difference between them being able to lease the entrance facility at a Telric price, or paying, either building something themselves or paying a third party to get
There's
that.
No third party. They are going to demand access at the entrance facility.
Well, then, if they're going to demand it from us.
Address my question the way I put it to you, if you would.
Okay. If they're going to address it by it from us, the difference is between paying the cost-based Telric price and paying the tariffed access charge price, which is a higher rate. That's where the monetary spread is. If we assume they're going to use the entrance facility, if they get it through interconnection, they get it at a cost-based Telric price. If they don't get it through interconnection under the Act, they pay access charges, which are regulated differently and tend to be higher. I take it that doesn't answer the question.
Well, you've now contradicted yourself, and I'm at sea about the pricing of the interconnection.
Maybe I'll move on to the fiber loops issue. And very briefly, since I think most of this will be on rebuttal, the FCC rules essentially say in most circumstances there's no duty to unbundle fiber loops. And they define a fiber loop.
Kindly slow down, please, and use English.
Okay. A fiber loop is a wire that connects an incumbent switch with an end user's premises and is composed either entirely or almost entirely of fiber optics rather than copper cable. The FCC rules say that in almost all circumstances, there's no duty to unbundle a fiber loop. In those rules, the FCC defines a fiber loop as one that connects to an end-user customer's premises or the customer's premises. In the ICC's order, they contend that the FCC's true intent, even though it's not stated in the rule, was to limit the definition of fiber loops to those that serve mass-market end-user customers. And a mass market customer would be either a residential customer or a small business customer.
Could I ask you a question about this? I infer, once again, from the briefs that these hybrid loops, fiber to the home loops, and fiber to the curb loops, as the FCC put it, are at least typically used by small users, such as residential users or maybe very small businesses, and medium-sized to large enterprises of various kinds, government, private enterprise, use some other technology to get the telecommunications service into the facility. Is that correct?
Yes, that's generally correct.
So when the FCC says in its orders, typically the hybrid or the fiber to the home, fiber to the curb are used by these small end users, That's an accurate statement.
Yes, I go along with the FCC on that one.
Okay. So because what I'm trying to figure, it looks to me as though what the CLECs are interested in is if these three different kinds of loops happen to be used by a big enterprise, they would love for you still to have to unbundle. And, of course, you don't want to unbundle. AT&T has never wanted to unbundle, so there's the obligation in the statute. But is that what this part of the case is really all about, whether you're going to have to do more generous unbundling at the enterprise end of these particular three kinds of loops?
Right. As a practical matter, that's it. As a legal matter, our focus is on the plain language of the rules.
No, I understand the plain language argument.
And I'll just summarize the plain language argument because it's really the ICC's cross appeal. But the plain language of the FCC's definitions of fiber loops doesn't include any limitation to mass market customers. The FCC's rule originally did limit the definition of fiber loops to residential end users, but the FCC issued an errata that deleted the word residential, which I think if you're going to look for the FCC's intent, that's the best evidence of the FCC's intent. And third, in the triennial review order itself, the FCC says in footnote 623 in paragraph 210 that while its analysis was going to focus on mass market end users for the most part, its rules would not be limited by any particular customer type. And those factors taken together demonstrate that the ICC can't read in, legitimately read in a mass market limitation to the fiber leaf rules. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Certainly, Mr. Covey. Mr. Rowland.
Good morning. My name is Thomas Rowland. I represent Simco Communications and XO Communications in this matter. I'm going to depart a little bit from what I had prepared because I think some of your questions hit exactly on the point of this case. And we're a little dumbfounded as to why the appeal was taken on this issue in this way. If we're talking about the microcosm in Illinois.
You could give us the answer, which Mr. Covey could not.
Well, I think I can, and I hope I can.
Tell the court what is at issue in the case. One begins to worry.
The issue is, can competitors continue to get interconnection facilities under C2 as they have for a very long time, in fact, predating the whole uni world?
That is not the issue, since we all agree that there's this statutory obligation and competitors are entitled to interconnect. That's why we're puzzled about what this case is about.
Well, the case is about price as well. AT&T doesn't really say that, but we now know that, in fact, is what's going on.
Could I ask you, one of the things that was before the ICC, and maybe I'm just too concretely minded here, but I referred to something that you've been leasing in the past that if it was changed over to simply interconnection, you weren't going to be charged a disconnect and a reconnect rate, and it was still going to be TELRIC pricing and all of that. What's that thing that you've been leasing? This is the entrance facility?
Yes, it's a facility, and it is a cable. That is correct. And
so you're not trying to lease any more than you were before. AT&T clearly doesn't want to lease it to you, at least not at a TELRIC rate.
Right.
I guess they'd be happy to lease it to you at a
And if you think about how this works in the world, you have big pipes, DS3s coming in, and you have little pipes, T1s, coming off of that. Some of those T1s are for interconnection only. They've never done any unbundling. That's to pass through all the traffic that we're talking about. And what's the traffic? Millions of customers in Illinois and outside of Illinois, transiting traffic going elsewhere, Citizens Utility, Consolidated Telephone. We're not talking about the CLEX parochial interests. We're talking about interconnection in a bigger sense.
So you're saying, I guess, that at least some of these connection points have always been dedicated to interconnection, others perhaps for this backhauling that you described.
Backhauling is relatively new just because we didn't have real competition in this way with competitive carriers the way we do today.
But now you've built up the infrastructure, and the backhauling isn't.
Well, one of the questions
when
you
have to build up the infrastructure.
Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no, go ahead.
One of the questions you get to, and when you ask about price, is like, well, wait a minute, are we talking about part of the public switch network? Yes, we are. And has part of this been paid for? Yes, it has. That's why the FCC looks at it and goes, TELRIC pricing. We're not going to let people build in anything else. And if you look at the statute, the discussion in 251, part of it is reasonable cost non-discrimination. You could have a situation here if they're able to charge special access rates, retail rates essentially, for interconnection alone. Who does more of this traffic?
They could be
put CLEX at a disadvantage.
Answer my question. What is the difference between the TELRIC pricing for leasing this facility and the price for interconnection?
Let me make sure I understand your question. What's the difference
I'm
in price?
I'm asking yet again what this case is about. It's not about whether the CLECs get access to this cable. They already have access to this cable and will continue to for the foreseeable future. This case is about the price, and I am trying to figure out what the difference in price is and why it is a difference in price.
There shouldn't be any difference in price. It should be TELRIC. The reality is if they charge, if they.
Why are you fighting?
We're protecting our clients to make sure that a silly decision.
No, look, this case before the ICC in the district court and here has cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees. Your client isn't paying you hundreds of thousands of dollars to fight about nothing. You must be fighting about something. And neither side seems willing to tell us what you are actually fighting about.
We would lose significant revenues for the cost of interconnection at non-TELRIC rates if that's what this...
So let me try
if
it
if they
this
got
way.
Their way in this. So there would be a huge difference. The difference could be two-thirds higher than it is under TELRIC.
Can I ask you this, Mr. Rowland? One possibility that has occurred to me is that what AT&T wants to do is to stop leasing the cable to you altogether and to make you somehow get yourself up to that cable but not use the cable. Is that right? Because I could at least understand is a difference. That would be a material change in circumstances for you if you now somehow didn't have the right to the cable at all, even for interconnection purposes.
Well, first of all, I think that would be a violation of 251C2.
I'm trying to.
In terms of what their argument is, I think they just want to charge a higher price.
For the use of the cable.
Right.
So they
right.
think that somehow the interconnection obligation stops just short of the cable, and you think the interconnection obligation gets you into the cable somehow so that you have to lease it.
The Supreme Court and the D.C. Circuit has indicated we're talking about facilities, functionality. We're talking about a facility. That is very clear.
Do you think the way I have described this is more or less accurate? It would be nice if I felt that I could understand the case.
I want to make sure I understand the way you're describing it.
I'm envisioning this cable
right.
that's the entrance facility, and I'm thinking that maybe what AT&T is saying is we used to have to lease this cable to you on TELRIC rates because subpart C was there and it was an unbundled network element. Now we don't have to lease the cable to you at all. You just have to get yourself up to the cable, but anything else you do with the cable, you have to pay market rates for. If that's what this is about, then all at least of the economic disputes between you would fall into place for me.
Right. No, it's more than that. It's actually having access to the cable itself.
Even access to the
right.
cable.
Right, and that's what the FCC has said clearly, and that's what the number of the courts have said. And it goes back into cases, you know, from the Supreme Court in the FCC Verizon case. So. This is not a new concept. The whole idea, again, of unbundling makes sense. You put costs where CLECs would incur or cause those costs, okay? And they can bring their facilities to a central office. With interconnection, we're talking about everybody. You know, the 9 million wireless callers in Illinois alone. How do you transit that traffic? You're not doing it with the parochial interests of a CLEC co-locating or being near a central office. You're talking about transiting all this other traffic. That's the issue. And that's why I say we can't decide something that would harm competition in Illinois and ignore what the FCC is doing in the bigger universe on this issue. Interconnection has been a fight for decades.
Thank you, Mr. Rowland.
Thank you.
Mr. Stanton.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Tom Stanton on behalf of the Commissioners of the Illinois Commerce Commission. And Judge Easterbrook, I think you've honed in on exactly the point. It is about price. And what AT&T has done is the FCC eliminated...
So could you perhaps tell us what the difference in prices is?
Yeah, there is no difference in price for purposes of... If
there is no difference in price, and this suit is about prices, then this suit is about nothing.
Yeah.
So there must be a difference in price. That's what's hitting me.
Yeah, the difference in price, interconnection facilities and unis are available at TELRIC prices. AT&T, once the FCC eliminated the unbundled network element, the entrance facility for unbundled element, AT&T tried to eliminate it for purposes of interconnection too, but the FCC makes a distinction. So they want either the CLECs to go out and have someone else provide it at a much higher cost, right, a non-TELRIC price, a market rate, or...
I hate to repeat this, but the it is the entrance facility or the interconnection point?
Yes, at any point in their network, these 251C2 allows CLEC to connect at any technically feasible point in the network, and that would include point of the entrance facility or any other point, even if they didn't want to use an entrance facility, any point in the network. That's right.
And I gather because entrance facilities could be cables, that's why they can be blocks or miles long?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Or conceivably just meters long. If you've got co-located switches, I assume this cable is a couple of meters long.
Yes. And for purposes of monitoring, Judge Easterbrook, you're absolutely right. The testimony at the ICC revealed that the CLECs and ILECs both know their switches, so they will know what uses.
Well, your brief says that, and AT&T didn't contradict it in its reply brief or at oral argument. I assume it is feasible to tell the use, but I assume that that comes with some expense. You'd have to devote some fraction of your computer's CPU to monitoring this, and it occurred to me that maybe what this was about was they didn't want that monitoring expense, but they haven't said that, so...
Yeah, they didn't raise that argument, and that doesn't seem to be that would be a large expense. I mean, they monitor the switches, both parties do, so that shouldn't be it.
Maybe you should talk about your loop argument, because I have to say it seemed to me the ICC's understanding of these regulations was quite strained.
Our cross appeal? Pardon?
Loopy, one might say.
Yeah. Judge Wood, our cross appeal?
Your cross appeal, yeah. Yes. I think of that as your loop argument, okay. But anyway.
Okay. Well, at the ICC, the parties presented the commission with two competing plausible interpretations of the rules.
Is that true, though? I mean, I think that's really where the district court judge left you. She didn't think that they were two equally reasonable interpretations. She thought that, in fact, the regulation just talked about these particular technological, you know, the hybrids, if you insist, the FTTH and the FTTC loops. And the commission, while speaking of typical use of those loops, didn't really care if somebody wanted to use one of those loops for an atypical user or an atypical reason.
Yeah. Well, I think the district court thought that we had not argued that the rules were ambiguous when, in fact, we did. So she just looked at the statute, didn't look at the history of the rules, didn't look at the MDU.
Well, why should she care whether you argued it or the history or anything else if she looked at it and said, I think this is unambiguous? Isn't that where she's supposed to stop at that point?
Well, you know, the commission found that they were ambiguous. And, you know, for a number of reasons, in the TRO, the FCC talks about a number of the reasons, the different unbundling analyses for mass market and for enterprise.
Sure, no, I mean, I understand that, mm-hmm. but I would say it's this court's responsibility as well to look at these statutes and regulations and come to our own conclusion whether there's any ambiguity there that needs disambiguating. And if we don't think so, I mean, maybe the ICC, it wouldn't be the first time, I would say, that somebody tries to argue to us that there's an ambiguity, and we look at a statute and we say, well, actually, we don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm just pointing out that the commission did find the ambiguity. And I think if you look at the MDU order, I think you can see why that the rule applies to mass market, because there would have been no reason for the FCC to distinguish between predominantly non-residential and non-predominantly residential if the entire universe of customers were already contained in the first clause of the rule. So I think that was one of the important things that the commission found. That the FCC did distinguish in that MDU order, which came after the TRO, after those the original FTTH rule, did distinguish between non-residential customers in MDUs. There's also another reason that we think that that the rule, as applied by the district court, is unreasonable, because it discriminates between enterprise customers based solely on whether they're located in single-customer buildings or in predominantly or non-predominantly residential MDUs.
But the FCC is entitled to draw lines. I mean, you say discriminate, which means in some sense simply it's treating two sets of customers a little differently, but these kinds of loops are also different. And the FCC, as I read the materials, is simply trying to create a rule for the most common use and the administrative costs of trying to fine-tune it any further, it may well have thought, were not worth it.
Yeah. But the FCC said that the stated purpose of providing limited unbundling relief, and that's what they did here, they provided limited unbundling relief to the ILEX, was because they wanted to incentivize the ILEX to go out and deploy these broadband loops to the mass market. The ILEX told the ICC, we have little incentive to go out and deploy these loops to the mass market if we have to turn around and give that loop to the CLEX at a Telric price. So what the FCC said was, okay, we will give you limited unbundling relief to the mass market, but the FCC specifically said that ILEX did not need the same incentive to deploy broadband loops or continue to deploy the broadband loops to the enterprise market.
Well, that leads to the question I asked your opponent, which is, you know, we're seeing half of the picture here, I have the feeling. There are these three different kinds of loops that the FCC says are typically used by what I think of as these very small users, residential, maybe small business. Of course, you know, large enterprises have telecommunications services delivered to them, but it was my impression that it was not through these kinds of loops. It was through something else. And so perhaps what the FCC was saying is we're going to give the incumbents unbundling relief. That is to say, they don't have to sell you things on an unbundled basis. Or not you. They don't have to sell their competitors on an unbundled basis for these kinds of loops. But for other sorts of things, the enterprise market in general, there's some other regime in place that we aren't worrying about in this case.
Well, fiber loops are used for both the mass market, these fiber to loop to the homes and things like that, and they're also used for the enterprise market, which you can, I mean, fiber is just a cable with fiber
optics. So what's the difference? You wouldn't have fiber to the home or fiber to the curb if you're supplying Boeing's headquarters?
No, you would run high capacity services
right.
like that,
the DS1
and D3 is right. So that's, that's why there's the distinction in the commission's decision on it. It's only limited to four DSOs, which are essentially ordinary voice lines or less. So the rules would apply.
Could you use English?
I'm sorry,
what is a DSO?
A DSO.
Sounds like a distinguished service organization.
A DSO is the digital equivalent of an ordinary voice line. So an ordinary voice line is your telephone line, a fax line.
If you could just stand firmly in front of the podium where you'll be recorded for many generations to come.
So the ordinary copper wire telephone line, the digital equivalent of that is a DSO. So when we talk about DSOs or telephone lines, the same thing. So a DSO is the copper is an analog, right? Legacy network, an analog service. The digital is just over the fiber, but it depends on the equipment at the two ends.
Could you tell me what DSO stands for? I take it the D stands for digital. What are S and O standing for?
I'm not sure what the S stands for, but
this is yet another reason why lawyers should not use acronyms. Acronyms may be fine for specialists. For generalists who actually need to know what the lawyers are talking about, it helps to use English. But all of you have heard our questions. This case may have been briefed and argued by and on behalf of specialists, but it's being argued to generalists.
And
if we can't understand what you're talking about, you're going to think our decisions are positively random.
And I have a briefing suggestion for lawyers who have cases like this, which is that you include, if you insist on having acronyms, you include an appendix or something in your brief. Because sometimes somebody will define an acronym on page 3, and then I'm off on page 35, and I think, when did they define that? And I'm sitting there flipping through the brief trying to find, what's an FTTH, and then I finally find it. So a little table of contents on that would be helpful.
Yeah, the D.C. Circuit local rules actually require this. I thought that our lawyers didn't need directives, but maybe
we should take a page from the D.C. Circuit, yes.
Your Honor, we do get caught up in our acronyms and our limited arcane area, but I guess even if the court should disagree with us on the merits, the court should still vacate the district court's permanent injunction. The district court erred in automatically entering that injunction at the end of the case. AT&T made absolutely no showing that it was entitled to an injunction. The court made no findings.
I must say, this argument loses me. And it loses me in large part because the premise on which this case is here is the ex parte Young fiction. Right? This is a lawsuit against Charles Box and other commissioners under the theory of ex parte Young. And what ex parte Young is about is injunctions entered against state officers. Now, since the premise on which we're here is ex parte Young, and the thing that ex parte Young authorizes is injunctions as distinguished from legal relief, your argument that legal relief should be used instead of an injunction seems to me, well, at odds with the theory of this litigation. So how is it that an injunction, how is it this suit can end in anything other than an injunction, given the ex parte Young rule?
Right. Well, the nature of the case is an administrative appeal. I mean, these cases come out.
Well, that may be its nature, but the Supreme Court held in the Verizon case, at the insistence of state regulators, like your clients, that this was not a suit to review the decision of the state agency, but was an ex parte Young case. And that's the question I'm asking you. So if you could deal with my question.
Ex parte Young doesn't require an injunction.
That's the only thing ex parte Young authorizes, is well, it not? I mean, where in the ex parte Young theory is the authorization for any other kind of relief?
They also asked for reversal. They also asked for a declaratory judgment. And under the Declaratory Judgment Act, the Supreme Court in the Steffel case said that Declaratory Judgment Act was designed to be a milder remedy than the injunction. So they've asked for reversal. They've asked for a declaratory judgment. We believe that would be sufficient.
I take it you aren't complaining, though, that there's anything unclear about the injunction. The district court did what she was supposed to do. She's got a separate entry of the permanent injunction, and she tells you what you're enjoined from doing. Is this just because you don't want contempt sanctions if you fail to comply?
That's one of the things. Obviously, the injunction is
to fail to comply.
No, Your Honor, but it's the principle and the idea that these, in our view, these are.
Well, look, if it's the principle of it that you're that state commissions didn't want injunctions entered, they shouldn't have told the Supreme Court to use the ex parte Young framework.
Well, if the court has no further questions, I'll.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Stanton. Anything further, Mr. Covey?
There were continued questions or the other arguments about what the entrance facilities issue is really all about. And I think, Judge Wood, when you were discussing the issue with the Celex attorney, you had it exactly right, which is that it's are the Celex, when they use an entrance facility, going to pay a regulated price or a market price?
For the use of that cable.
For the use of that cable, yes.
Okay.
And that's where the dollars are, and that's why we're here on appeal. One other point I'd like to make that I didn't make the first time around is there was some discussion
is
about
there any doubt about the authority of the ICC to regulate the price for interconnection?
Subject to the FCC's. It applies to the FCC's methodology.
What the Illinois Commerce Commission had done in this case was to enter an order saying the price for interconnection shall be equivalent to the TELRIC price for unbundled network elements. Right? That's the order, period.
Okay.
Is there any legal problem with that order?
Yes, because under our reading of the statute, The definition of interconnection doesn't include the use of incumbent-like network elements. That's covered.
You're not addressing my question. Just listen to the question.
Okay.
The Illinois Commerce Commission enters an order saying the price for interconnection under C2 shall be equal to what would be the price for a... Let me refer. The price for interconnection under C2 shall be set by the TELRIC methodology, period.
Yes.
Any legal problem with saying that?
No. The dispute here is what does interconnection include? But as an abstract statement, that's correct. The pricing for interconnection is set using that TELRIC methodology.
I don't know how my statement can be correct or not. I was asking whether there was a legal problem.
No.
Okay.
There was discussion earlier about...
So what this case is really about, then, is that what AT&T proposes to do is send in a tariff for interconnection with a price that is higher than TELRIC, and it hopes that the ICC doesn't disapprove that tariff.
You mean if the order stays in place?
No, if you succeed, what you want to do...
If you win, if we reverse, then there will still be interconnection at the entrance facility. AT&T will file a tariff with a price that is higher than the TELRIC price, and AT&T hopes that the ICC will allow that tariff to become effective. Is that what this case is about?
We already have a... If we're not providing an entrance facility as part of interconnection, there's already a tariff in place that charges for the service of using that access facility, or that entrance facility. There's already a higher price set. Is there no further questions?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.